Support for this podcast comes from San Francisco International Airport. At SFO, you can discover award-winning flavors and unique shops all before takeoff. Learn more about what's at SFO at flysfo.com.
Hey, it's Avery Trufelman, host of Articles of Interest. And I've got to say, I've been a fan of KQED ever since I was a little kid, and I would come out to San Francisco to visit my grandma. It was just what we'd always turn on every time we got in the car, every time we were making dinner and turning on the radio. It was always KQED. And then over the years, I've become a massive fan of KQED podcasts because this is local reporting at its best. These are answers to questions you've always wanted to know, interviews with exciting, unusual voices, necessary journalism, all told with love and care and artistry. And did you know that a majority of KQED's funding actually comes from members? It's just people like you and me supporting the programs they love, while also getting access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. If you want to sign up and be a part of this amazing community, visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to become a member today. That's podcasts with an S. Thank you for listening, and thank you for your support.
From KQED.
What's going on with the cherry blossoms?
I think they're kind of over. I think they peaked and then they left.
This is Political Breakdown from KQED in San Francisco. I'm Scott Schaefer. Today on The Breakdown, journalist Mark Leibovich has become the ultimate chronicler of inside the Beltway politics and politicians. He's a shrewd observer of presidents, congressional leaders, insurgents, and insiders, capturing it all in books like This Town from 2013, which describe what he calls the carnival that Washington, D.C. has become. As a staff writer for The Atlantic, Leibovich has written a profile of California's governor titled Gavin Newsom Can't Help Himself. He joins us to talk about the state of politics in a year rocked by Israel's war in Gaza, the prospect of Donald Trump returning to power, and the rematch no one seems to have wanted between the current and former presidents. Mark Leibovich, welcome to Political Breakdown.
Good to be with you.
Mark, let me begin by asking you about this profile in The Atlantic. It's titled Gavin Newsom Can't Help Himself. You write that, quote, Newsom is 56, but emits the frenetic energy of an upstart. Is that energy, do you think, is it endearing? Is it annoying? What is it?
Well, I mean, it sort of depends who you ask. I mean, Newsom is, I mean, he looks great for his age. He typically does. I mean, he's a very good-looking guy. He has sort of this exuberance of youth about him, even though, you know, he's well into middle age now. He is absolutely ambitious. He's absolutely talented. And I think one of the stories, though, behind the just the conceit that Gavin Newsom can't help himself is that he pushes things out to the edge a little bit. I mean, he clearly likes kind of edgy media environments, whether it's going on Fox News, going into a spin room after a Republican debate, going on shows like Real Time with Bill Maher, and even saying things to profile writers like me at a time when maybe, and he would say probably explicitly, you know, it might be better for someone like him to lay a little low, given that there are a lot of people who wonder if he's really kind of loyal to the cause of Biden's reelection, or is kind of out for promoting his own national profile, given that he might want to run for president one day. And many people thought it would be this year, but it looks like that's not going to happen, but certainly sometime in the future.
Yeah. And you wrote that you've been trying to set up an interview with Newsom for quite some time and you were put off until recently. Why do you think that is? Is it part of a can't help himself?
Yeah, I mean, well, both sort of the two parts is, I mean, I think clearly he probably would have rather I didn't come asking. I'm thrilled that he said yes, ultimately. It did take a while. I think what he did was, I mean, I've known him a while. I wrote about him pretty extensively when I worked for the New York Times Magazine, and he was then mayor of San Francisco, about to run for governor the first time. This was in 2010. He wound up running for lieutenant governor. But we spent a lot of time together for a story then. We've kept in touch over the years, but I think, you know, it was definitely, he wanted to get through the State of the Union address. He wanted to get through the primaries. I mean, Biden has obviously clinched the Democratic nomination at this point. So the noise around the Newsom shadow campaign, or will he step in and actually run for the job that Biden is running for, has kind of subsided quite a bit. And that's something that he has battled with. But ultimately, yeah, I was happy to wait. I mean, I wasn't happy to wait, but that's what he chose. And I think eventually he got to yes. And I think the issues around him and around Biden and around this election are just as poignant now as they were in January.
He has an interesting dynamic and relationship with Kamala Harris. They both got elected in San Francisco. She was the DA. He was the mayor, got elected in 2003. And they're kind of frenemies now. And of course, she could stand in the way of him running for president or becoming president. Did he talk about her at all?
A little bit. I was actually quite interested in talking to her. I mean, I talked to a lot of people he has a lot of very close, high profile allies and frenemies actually over the years, whether it's, Nancy Pelosi's been kind of a mentor. Willie Brown has been a mentor. And then there are people like Jerry Brown, who he served under for 8 years, who definitely a frenemy. I mean, they kind of ran against each other in 2010 for a little bit until Newsom decided to run for lieutenant governor. Pat Brown, Jerry's father, or no, Jerry himself actually appointed Gavin's father to the bench back in the 70s. So, I mean, there's a lot of interconnection there. But Kamala is different because they're more peers. They're roughly the same age. They've known each other a long time. And I really tried to talk to Kamala. It looked like she was going to say yes. And I was going to get an answer, I think it was a couple of Mondays ago. And then that thing happened with the Jose Andres
bombing.
The bombing, yes, in Gaza. And she was close to, she's, where people said, she's focused on that today, which is kind of a weird excuse. I was working on it all week, but she was focused on that today. So there was no chance. They sent me a statement. So there was definitely an arm's length kind of thing going on with Kamala. But yeah, it'll be interesting to see if they wind up going head to head in 2028.
He clearly wants to be president. And I sort of see him as like a thoroughbred horse, waiting for the gate to open so he can take off down the track. What do you see, based on what you've learned in talking with him and watching him, what do you see as the pros and cons of him as a national figure and a potential presidential candidate?
Yeah, I mean, the definite pro is that he's very talented. He's very good at this. This being just sort of going on TV and being an evangelist for blue state issues. I mean, he has a lot of room to run because he is governor of a very blue state. He's extremely eloquent as a spokesperson for progressive climate agenda, gun agenda, agenda on
abortion, certainly.
Abortion, certainly, he's led with that. I mean, he wants to make California an abortion sanctuary. So those are like the big three issues now. But not only does he talk about it, but he does it in a very frontal way. Like he actually went after Ron DeSantis. He goes into very red states like South Carolina, Idaho. I mean, he's been all over the country and has really sort of taken the mantle very, very aggressively about liberal issues that in a way that Biden doesn't really do that well these days. And, Biden doesn't love talking about abortion. He talks somewhat about climate, but not that much. Guns, he's been somewhat aggressive. Anyway, Newsom is very good on that. I think he could become very compelling with the base in an environment like that. The downside is, everything about California he kind of owns. And California is a very fraught state. It contains multitudes for reasons fabulous and not so fabulous. And there will be a lot to pin him on. And I think also, he has some self-destructive tendencies that have been well documented over the years.
You write that he appears to have a fascination with Donald Trump and not just as an evil adversary. Newsom, who campaigned in 2018 on a pledge to make California a resistance state, likes to mention he worked well with Trump during his first 2 years in Sacramento. What do you make of that?
Well, I mean, I think part of it is good politics. I mean, yes, for as despised as Donald Trump is among, many progressives and certainly actually every progressive and many people in California, California did fairly well given the crisis environment that for those 2 years, I mean, around COVID, around the wildfires. And, and those things involved some pretty, close interplay with the federal government. California got a lot of reimbursement that red states didn't get. he and Trump talk to each other. And I think, you know, no matter how much people dislike or might dislike Donald Trump in the state, I think there is always a very good look behind two leaders working together, no matter how far apart they are, in ways that, people think benefits their state and their interests. So he definitely did that. But he also talked about Trump and sort of was fascinated by him and sort of the dynamic of Trump in the media, how, you know, what makes him tick. And I sense that it goes beyond the sort of knee-jerk revulsion that you hear from a lot of Democratic politicians when they talk about Trump. I mean, it seemed in some ways that he really valued their relationship.
Yeah, and I think they both actually kind of enjoy that back and forth that they had when Trump was president. All right, we're going to continue our conversation with Mark Leibovich in a minute. You're listening to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sasha Coca, host of the California Report magazine. Every week, we bring you stories about what connects us in the giant, diverse Golden State. Because what happens in California changes the world.
I love this place. We were once seen as like the place to be, California. The land of milk and honey. That's where you go to Sunshine State. But we just have challenges right now.
KQED's California Report magazine. New episodes drop every Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey there, this is Brittany Luce from NPR's It's Been a Minute. KQED's podcasts like The Bay, Bay Curious, Mind Shift, Right Nowish, and more all tell the stories of the Bay and beyond with reliable, human-centered journalism. They aim to inspire, make you think, entertain, and expand your understanding of the place you call home. Here's how you can support podcasting at KQED.
Showing your support is easy, and you can join Brittany in supporting KQED Podcast too at donate.kqed.org/podcast. That's donate.kqed.org/podcast.
And welcome back to Political Breakdown. I'm Scott Schaefer. My guest today is The Atlantic's staff writer, Mark Leibovich. He's got a profile of Governor Gavin Newsom this month, and he's the author of a number of books, including This Town, Two Parties and a Funeral, plus Plenty of Valet Parking in America's Gilded Capital. Well, Mark, let's talk about Donald Trump. In some ways, the best thing for Newsom, politically speaking, would be for Trump to get elected. And that would clearly kind of in some ways open up the field for a Democrat, make the environment might be better for a Democrat in 2028. You know, what do you think is Newsom's calculation about 2024?
Well, I mean, I think Newsom quite genuinely wants Biden to win. I mean, I don't think he has any sort of secret agenda of, you know, being, you know, having a Trump part two. I mean, I think, you know, Newsom lived enough of that. And I think he's enough of a Democrat to know what that could look like. I honestly don't know if a Trump presidency or another Biden term would advantage or disadvantage a Democrat in 2028 necessarily. I mean, the fact is, it's going to be a wide open field. There's going to be no incumbent, obviously. And I think that there is going to be an overwhelming gratitude that voters have about to be moving on from the Biden, Trump, kind of Clinton hammer lock that we've been living through these number of years. So it'll be fascinating to see. I think, you know, Newsom one way or the other will be a fairly new face on the national scene.
Yeah, I think the one potential caveat is if Biden steps down before his 4 years is up or is, you know, leaves for one reason or another and Kamala Harris becomes president. But we'll set that aside for another day. I want to ask you about Congress. We've seen some remarkable action, stuff getting done in the past few days. The House passed a total of $95 billion in appropriations for Israel, relief for Palestinians, Ukraine, Taiwan. What do you make of Speaker Mike Johnson, who really has gotten a lot of credit for staring down the most extreme elements of his party?
Yeah, I mean, it's been kind of a rare moment of uplift around here. I mean, I think, you know, it's always nice when someone who everyone has kind of dismissed as being, you know, beyond salvation really comes around and seemed to really listen to reason and read, you know, really dug into some intelligence, seemed to really, you know, be convinced of what he was doing. I mean, the question now is, what will the price be for him? I mean, there could be some kind of action against his job from the far right in Congress, which is still extremely formidable in the next week or so. But look, I mean, he's clearly, he has some kind of line to Democrats. I think Democrats will probably help save him if and when there is a motion to vacate. And so that's, you know, one thing this Congress has been, in addition to utterly dysfunctional, it's been fascinating to watch. And I think this is another chapter of that. And it's nice that it's been actually underlined by some uplift and actually getting something done that a lot of people care deeply about.
You know, as a backbencher, Johnson consistently voted against aid for Ukraine, along with, you know, many in his party. And I'm wondering, you know, based on what you know about the way D.C. works, you know, what is it that accounts for this transformation in him? I mean, you know, he's in charge now. And in some ways, Republicans, it seems, they'd like to be on the outside, you know, not governing, but criticizing the government.
Yeah, it's an interesting question. I mean, I think when you're a backbencher, you don't have a lot of information, ultimately. I mean, I think... And you know, maybe this is a Pollyannish way of looking at it, but I think he probably has been genuinely influenced by talking to the leadership, by talking to the intelligence community, by talking to the president, by going to the White House, by being treated as a full partner in what is a very serious moment in the government. So I'd like to think that maybe, you know, he has been humbled by that and has chosen to act responsibly in the best interest of the country, in the best interests of making a deal, rather than, you know, satisfying that very, very tight corner of the right and the Trump right that is such a fool's errand at this point. But again, I mean, you could argue that Kevin McCarthy lost his job because he did responsible things. I mean, he cut a debt ceiling deal. He kept the government open. And next thing you know, he's being, he's being vacated and he's not speaker anymore.
Yeah, although the key difference there perhaps is that Democrats really didn't trust him and trust him to keep his word and do what he said he was going to do. In that sense, it does seem sort of surprisingly that for whatever reason, there is more of a solid relationship between this speaker, Mike Johnson, and Democrats.
Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, I think Johnson in some ways hasn't been around long enough to be distrusted to the degree that McCarthy has. I mean, McCarthy has, you know, he came to the distrust he had from both within his own caucus, but certainly Democrats, quite honestly, over many, many years. I mean, he had quite a kind of a broken road behind him. Johnson, to some degree, I think, benefited from the blank slate that he was and continues to be. But we'll see. I mean, look, this is a moment in time. But I think, you know, again, compared to the moments that Republicans have been presiding over, it's certainly preferable.
Well, let's talk about Joe Biden. You had an article in The Atlantic on March 6th, which I think was the day before the State of the Union address. Yeah. And you wrote, "In speaking with Democrats about the president's reelection chances, I often pick up a sharp tone that goes beyond resignation. It sounds more like rage." What was the rage, do you think? Where was that coming from? What was it?
Real exasperation. I mean, I've written versions of that piece a couple of times. I mean, I'm certainly one of the people who has, written a lot about the age issue. I think one of the things I wanted to focus on is it's not just so much the guy's too old to be president. I mean, whether he is or he isn't, I mean, that's sort of, you know, we'll see what the election does. But I mean, he did kind of bait and switch in the eyes of many voters, which is many people assumed that he was a one-term president. He was going to kind of bring this country under control, rescue it from Donald Trump, and then step aside to the next generation, literally his words, or be a bridge to the next generation, also literally his words, in 2024. And instead he stuck around. And, you know, there are still real questions about whether he, in his current political standing, can beat Donald Trump in this year's election, which is by far, you know, the most important election, you know, many of us will see, certainly because it's in front of us. So anyway, I think there was a lot of anger about that. I think it's going to subside as we move closer to the election. I also think the State of the Union did something to, you know, maybe put that on the back burner faster than it could have been.
How much of Biden's, you know, unwillingness to step aside do you think was just, you know, here's a guy who always wanted to be president and now he's reluctant to give it up versus like not having faith in his vice president, Kamala Harris, and her ability to unite the party and win?
Yeah, I think... I it wouldn't shock me if there's some of the latter. I don't have any firsthand knowledge of it. I will say, just generally, the guy loves the gig. I mean, people I know who I talk to around the White House who are close to Biden, who know Biden, says, I mean, yes, presidents become very kind of addicted to the power. It's not certainly not true of only presidents. It's just people in politics. But oh man, it seems to really suit him, at least in his mind. And, You know, look, it's he's allowed to run again. And, you know, it's someone else is allowed to jump in and try to, like, take the nomination from him. And no one did. I mean, except for a few minor characters. And, you know, so, yeah, it was his to lose. And he didn't lose it because no one really ran against him. So here we are.
What are you hearing from Democrats in terms of the reaction and the situation in Gaza? We're seeing, you know, unrelenting protests on college campuses here in the Bay Area. You know, bridge was shut. The Golden Gate Bridge was shut down. There's been really a lot of unrest, especially among younger people who Biden kind of needs if he's going to get reelected. Yeah. I mean, how nervous are Democrats and like, what do they think could help turn the page on that anger? And you know, if anything.
Yeah, it's hard. I mean, the if anything is kind of the key word there. I mean, you sort of look at something like this from the outside, whether you agree with Biden's, you know, philosophy on this or not, whether, you know, no matter where you are on the issue, it is a tough needle to thread if you are a president of the United States. And it's not like there's a lot of recent U.S. presidents who have perfectly threaded the needle on the Middle East. I mean, this is an extremely volatile place for broken dreams. I mean, the problem, you know, really in a very palpable way for Biden is that, I mean, these protests are breaking out no matter where he goes, no matter where Democratic politicians go. And, you know, the big question is, how many are there? Is this just a loud minority, or is this going to be a critical mass that could cost him, you know, enough young voters in states that are very close with big college campuses like Michigan and, you know, Pennsylvania and Wisconsin and, you know, go around the country? Or is this just sort of a loud minority? And is the support for Israel so strong? And it's sort of assumed that a Democratic or even Republican president would stand firmly for Israel. So I don't know. I don't know what the calculation is. It's sort of hard enough to even begin before you even bring politics into it.
Yeah, and then, of course, we've got the Democratic National Convention in Chicago. And of course, there's going to be a lot of comparisons to 1968 when the anti-war demonstrations broke out and how the police there handled that. You know, what do you make of that narrative? I mean, are Democrats nervous about that?
I mean, I think they should be. I mean, I think they clearly are. I mean, you talk to enough of them. I mean, the Chicago symbolism and actual, you know, there's definitely a historic, you know, echo, resonance, whatever you want to call it, that gives it an extra kind of oomph. But I also think that, look, I mean, this is the gathering. I mean, it's not just a single speech. It's not a single event. It's not a campus visit. I mean, this is everyone who has been or will be protested gathering in one place, you know, with high security, high tension, extremely high passions. You know, it should be fascinating. I'm going to go. I'm not sure what I'm going to find. So, yeah, I don't know. I mean, that's definitely something a lot of Democrats are nervous about and talking about.
Well, another kind of echo, I guess, is the name Robert F. Kennedy. Of course, he had just been assassinated in 1968. And of course, now we've got his son, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., running. What do you make of his candidacy? I mean, you know, there was a lot of conventional wisdom that it was going to draw votes from Biden. There's a more recent poll out that shows, well, maybe he's actually pulling more support from Trump. He's getting a lot of Republican money. Kind of an odd mishmash of things.
Yeah, no, it is the big X factor here. And I can tell you that both sides are extremely nervous about him because, I mean, it's just such a wild card. I mean, there's never been anything like this before. I mean, the knee-jerk concern for Democrats is, you know, RFK. It's the quintessential Democratic campaign. But, you know, these numbers are kind of very inconclusive so far if you look at kind of the three head-to-head with Kennedy polls. I know Newsom is extremely concerned about it. You know, he talks to the Biden campaign a lot. It was a recurring topic of conversation between us. You know, I will say that there is a absolute hardcore anti-vax base within the Republican Party that is pretty close to a single issue, you know, group at a certain point. And RFK is really the only pure candidate there. I mean, Trump certainly isn't. I mean, he, you know, gets credit for actually developing the vaccine or at least presiding over the operation.
And he got the vaccine. He took the vaccine.
Got the vaccine. Operation Warp Speed is arguably, you know, his greatest accomplishment as president, which, you know, I would certainly think is definitely right up there. But again, that is something he doesn't talk about, cannot talk about, gets booed when he talks about his rallies. And it's a dangerous issue to him because if he talks about it, it's going to drive his supporters or some supporters possibly into the arms of RFK. So fascinating dynamics in either direction. Who knows how it'll play out?
I asked you a little bit earlier about Kamala Harris, of course, former senator from California, AG as well. she's, you know, her approval ratings are, you know, as bad or a little worse than Biden in most polls. Is that just, you know, who loves a VP? Nobody really loves the vice president. Or is there something unique about her being a woman of mixed racial background? And do you think maybe she's underestimated in this race?
I don't think she's underestimated in this race. I mean, you're right. I mean, vice presidents are not necessarily, you know, celebrated. It's kind of it's seen as a hapless job. But I mean, Biden wasn't necessarily an unpopular vice president. Pence wasn't an unpopular vice president among Republicans. I mean, there is definitely some kind of, you know, there's something about Kamala Harris that never really took off in the public's imagination, even after Biden chose her. You know, it's a thankless job. It's hard to sort of come out from under an initial persona, but it also didn't help her that she ran, you know, not a great presidential race. I mean, she didn't even make it to like the first votes casting. So, I don't know. I mean, I don't envy her position, but you know, maybe she can, I mean, I assume she'll serve some role on the campaign that will hopefully help the campaign, you know, from their perspective, but also help her from her perspective.
Yeah, I mean, she could be a bridge to younger voters, maybe especially women of color. She was out in front, at least by the administration standards, on calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. So, you know, maybe some of that accrues to the ticket's advantage. Who knows?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, like, it's not like she captured anyone's imagination when she ran in 2020. So again, she's sort of starting from a bit of a standing position.
Well, of course, Trump has to pick a VP, a running mate as well. And of course, he's, you know, doing it rather publicly, auditioning people and so on. What do you like both? Who do you think would be the best choice politically? And like, what are you hearing in terms of what he's looking for?
Ooh, I don't know. I mean, with Trump, you know, you always have to sort of go to the central casting thing. I mean, he likes visuals. He likes someone who will look good on stage, especially next to him, but also someone who will be 100% deferential. You know, a name you keep hearing a lot is Tim Scott. He definitely clears the 100% deferential bar. He's also African-American, and he ran, so he's somewhat vetted before. And look, I mean, Trump seems to be cutting into the assumed advantage that Biden was going to have among Black and Hispanic voters. And look, I mean, it doesn't take that much more of an erosion of the African-American vote for Democrats to really lose some sort of built-in edge that they previously had in states like Michigan and Pennsylvania, and even places like Georgia, you know, where Tim Scott conceivably could be very healthy or can be very helpful to him.
Mark, before I let you go, you know, you've written about so many different kinds of people. You've written, obviously, about presidents, a lot of people who are well-known, Gavin Newsom, Donald Trump, but others not so much. You know, people who are known maybe inside the Beltway or inside the dome in the Capitol. I'm thinking of Kurt Bardella, who was an aide to Daryl Issa, who was in your book. Like, what draws you into somebody to the point where you think, you know, I'm going to write about this person, even though nobody really knows who they are?
Yeah, I mean, Kurt Bardella, who, you know, nobody knows who he is, or never, they didn't before, and they still basically don't. You know, you need to kind of really rise to a level of I'm always fascinated that, I guess my bias is to, what is it like to have this person's life? I mean, part of it is just sort of obvious, like, okay, he's the president of the United States, or he's running for president of the United States. A guy like Newsom is interesting because, you know, he obviously wants something, but he can't talk about wanting it because, you know, the wanting is he wants to be president. He's very ambitious, but he can't talk about himself. He can talk about himself, but he, you know, he can't. He's supposed to be like a super surrogate for Joe Biden, which requires humility and, you know, things that don't necessarily, I mean, not that he's not humble, but he doesn't play it, you know, very convincingly on TV. So, yeah, I mean, look, there's no rhyme or reason to it. I mean, anything that appears interesting or occasionally is just assigned to me and falls in my lap, I will go after, and it's my job to make it somewhat interesting. And you know, on a good day, maybe I do.
All right. I think you've had a lot of good days. Mark Leibovich is an Atlantic staff writer. He's got a profile of Gavin Newsom this past month, a couple weeks ago, I guess it was now. And you can check out any of his books, including This Town, which is definitely a fun read. Mark, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, Scott. Good to be with you.
And that's a wrap for Tuesday, April 23rd. Political Breakdown is a production of KQED. Our engineer is Seal Muller, and our producer is Dana Cronin. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening.
Hey, it's Glenn Washington from Snap Judgment. And if you love what you're hearing, and I know you love what you're hearing. Please consider becoming a KQED member. Get special access to cool events, behind-the-scenes footage, and so much more. Plus, you'll sleep better at night, knowing you did your part for the community you depend upon. It's in you. Please be in it. Visit donate.kqed.org/podcasts to sign up now. That's podcast with an S. Thanks.